Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. It's finally feeling like spring. I'm so excited about that. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest will be Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern. She is the author of a new book called The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability. And she's also a professor, associate professor of food studies at Syracuse University. And I'll tell you more about her when she comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news. Last night was my Zoom cooking class where we made linguine puttanesca with fire-roasted tomatoes, artichokes, capers, and olives. And I'm going to be sharing that recipe with all of you today. But my cooking classes are just turning out to be such a wonderful way to connect with people. You know, I'm such a people-oriented person, and this coronavirus has really put a damper on that. We're certainly self-quarantining and staying home and not seeing people. And, you know, cooking and feeding people is what I have been doing for so many years, and it's really been a challenge to change that over. So the Zoom cooking classes not only give me a way to share with everybody that I would like to be sitting around the table with, but it's also a way to inspire people to eat more plant-forward diets and also how to get dinner on the table quickly. So we're going over knife skills, and, you know, I throw in things about the Environmental Working Group and the Dirty Dozen list and arsenic in rice and all these tips on food that, you know, I've just gathered over the years, and it's an opportunity to share with everyone. So I will be continuing the classes. They are on Wednesday at 5 o'clock, although that time might be moving 1 hour later to 6 o'clock. I've asked people to write to me and let me know whether they would prefer to start at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. I originally picked 5 o'clock, thinking young mothers want to get dinner on the table by 6, but most of the people joining me are not the young mothers that I thought would be joining me. So the people that are joining, I think, would prefer it to be maybe an hour later. So anyway, send me feedback at that. You can write to me in an email at bhavani@iegreen.com or send me a text. My cell phone number is on my website. So now I want to share with you some other things going on in and around the news that you can participate in. This week, actually, I'll share with you was the National Organic Coalition, which NOFA New York, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, is a part of this coalition. They had a lobbying week, a fly-in days with our senators and representatives. And I participated in a meeting with Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand, and then with Representative Tom Suozzi's office. And these fly-ins were just an opportunity for the National Organic Coalition to share with everybody or with the offices things that we'd like to see moving forward. Like in this current administration, the Trump administration has reversed a rule that the past administration had put into place, which was the origin of livestock rule, which actually would tell you where an animal was coming from before it's allowed to become organic. And that was really, you know, the origin of livestock, which is also OOL, is a loophole that allows organic factory farms to actually bring in cows that were not raised organically and instantly start them as organic. And that just puts real, true organic dairy farmers at a disservice. There's also an organic pasture rule that's really important that is a loophole. Organic dairy farmers, all those cows are supposed to get out to pasture every day, and that's not happening in the factory farm organic dairy. So like I've said before, all organic is not the same. All broccolis are not the same. It's really important to kind of do your research, and that's why I love sharing the Environmental Working Group's website and Cornucopia Institute's website, because they have lists that say which organic is better than others, which eggs are better, which suntan lotion is better. As we come into the summer, you want to know which suntan lotions are safe to put all over your skin or your child's skin. So these are really great websites that you all want to know about. Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren have also co-sponsored a bill to end factory farming by 2040, which is really exciting, and also to limit the expansion of any current factory farms and not to give any more permits out. So that's a really great, great bill as well. And, you know, there's things going on that that need awareness. And this opportunity for me to sit in on these lobbying days and to participate was really, really very fruitful. I learned a lot. And it felt good to take a part in our democratic process, which our current administration is trying to do away with. So I encourage you all to get involved. There's a bill, actually, the Senate bill right now that's been introduced to require airlines to refund all money for flights that have been canceled. You know, I was planning on taking my family to Portugal the end of this month, and they were offering us a voucher. We were eight of us, and they were offering us a voucher, said that it had to be used within a year of the original booking. Now, we booked this back in February. So if it's not safe to travel anytime now in the next 6 months with warm weather. Who wants to travel if it becomes safe in the middle of January? So, and they didn't want to give me back my money. I really had to fight with them, and eventually I did get my money back. So right now, while it's not a law, you can put up a big stink and hopefully get your money back. But they were just giving vouchers, and so this Senate bill is going to require airlines to give cash refunds. So that's a huge step forward for so many people. I've also been writing about bee colony collapse for years now. This has been going on, and pesticides have been linked to this. I've written about neonicotinoids quite a bit. Now I'm writing about pyrethroids. You know, I'm probably saying them wrong. But anyway, this is a pesticide that is linked to bee decline. It's also really bad for our health. It's been linked to autism, Parkinson's disease, and Alzheimer's. And it's also not safe for kids. And this current administration, actually, instead of, you know, looking at the safety, they've actually increased the safety limits for children three times. So they're now saying that kids can be exposed to three times more than what was currently listed as the safety level, just so that they don't have to take it off the market. So get involved. I mean, you know, what's going on now with this administration is just really, really harmful. There's lots of also great things happening. A silver lining to this virus is with all this homeschooling that's going on. There's lots of organizations that are stepping up to the plate and offering free webinars. And the Queens County Farm Museum has a bunch on their website that you can link onto. There's one that I just came across called Growing Minds. I have a link on my website to them as well, and they're doing weekly theme-related classes for kids relating to food, gardens, nature, and, you know, that's really a wonderful thing, too. So there's ways that you can, you know, help while we're quarantined at home to get involved in our political process, get involved in making your child's education really richer. So I encourage all of us to do that. So I want to share with you now my recipe that I made yesterday with my Zoom cooking class. This linguine puttanesca sauce is really, really versatile. It's so easy to put together, and the majority of the ingredients are in your pantry, or if they're not, they should be. These are really great staples that you just want to have in your pantry at all times. And this sauce can also be put on in the summer. I've put this on zucchini noodles that I'll make. You know, I have a vegerator that just, you know, turns my zucchinis into long noodle-shaped pieces. And this sauce on top of that is just so satisfying and delicious. when I was eating fish, I also would make this sauce and put it on top of fish. Just make the sauce, put it on top of the fish, and bake it in the oven until the fish is done. And it's just also really, really great. You can also put it on top of tofu cutlets, on top of tempeh cutlets. It's, like I'm saying, so versatile. So this recipe, from your pantry, you want to have a box of organic pasta. I used organic brown rice and millet pasta that I get at Trader Joe's that I love, organic linguine, whole wheat, gluten-free, whatever is good for you, one organic onion diced, which is about 2 cups worth, 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic, 6 to 8 organic cremini mushrooms. I had 2 large portobello mushrooms that I used, and that worked as well, 1 yellow pepper diced, 2 tablespoons of organic tomato paste, 1 large can fire-roasted tomatoes, 1 can of artichoke hearts, and I buy the artichoke hearts that are already cut in quarters, just makes it much easier, 1/4 cup of small capers, 1/4 to 1/2 teaspoon of red chili flakes, and that's optional, but it depends on how spicy you like it. I thought I made it pretty spicy, and my husband was still adding more on to his individual bowl as we ate dinner last night. So it's really, it can be added in the whole sauce or it can be added individually if some people like it spicy and some don't. 1 teaspoon of oregano, 1 teaspoon of basil, 1 cup of organic Kalamata olives, sliced. Depending on the size, either you can just cut them in half or I was cutting them into thirds. 1/2 cup of chopped Italian parsley, stems removed, 1/4 cup of white wine, salt and pepper to taste, and olive oil. And you're going to start by covering the bottom of a wok or whatever deep sauté pan you want to make this sauce into with some olive oil. When the olive oil is hot, you can add the onions and let those cook for about 5 minutes till they start to become translucent. Then you're going to add the garlic and the mushrooms and cook that for a few more minutes. And you're going to wait till the mushrooms start getting soft. Then you're going to push those vegetables to the side just so you make a space in the bottom center of the wok or saute pan, and you're going to add the 2 tablespoons of tomato paste to the center of the wok and let that cook just for a couple minutes there, and that kind of brings out the flavor of the tomato paste, deepens the flavor a bit, which is really helpful. Take some of the acidity out of the tomato paste. Then you're going to add the peppers, the white wine, the oregano, and the basil right back into that wok and mix it all up and let that cook for another few minutes. Then you're going to add the fire-roasted tomatoes, the artichokes, the olives, and the capers. Season it with salt and pepper. And let it cook again. Let all those flavors come together. Meanwhile, while you're doing this, actually before you even start the sauce, put the pot of water on to boil. That actually was what held us up last night in the recipe. I kind of put the sauce together, and then I turned the water on, and we ended up having to wait for the pasta to cook. So this sauce really comes together so fast. By the time the water is boiling and you cook the pasta, it will all be ready at the same time. So it's perfect that way. You cook the pasta al dente. If you're using a gluten-free pasta like I did, the brown rice and quinoa pasta, it's really essential that you run it under water after you cook it. If you're going to let it sit for a while and not use it right away, you can run cold water on it just to stop the cooking process. But if you're going to use it right away, you can actually run warm water over it. But what you're doing is you're washing the starch off of the pasta. The gluten-free pasta tends to get mushy if you just let it sit by itself because of the coating. And a lot of the coating comes off actually in the water when you're boiling it. I always say that a pound of the gluten-free pasta is never as much as a pound of the regular pasta. But anyway, you're going to then put the pasta into the bowl and cover it with sauce, or you can put the pasta into the sauce pot and mix it up there. Put it into your serving dish. Garnish it with fresh parsley. Actually, you want to add some fresh parsley to it and mix it in first, and then save some fresh parsley for the top for garnish. I serve this with a vegan Caesar salad dressing, and that's just, onto romaine lettuce. And basically, I'm using capers as my saltiness instead of anchovies. So for the vegan salad dressing, you just want 2 cloves of garlic, 2 tablespoons of capers, 1 tablespoon of Dijon mustard, 2 lemons juiced, 1 tablespoon chopped parsley, 1/2 cup extra virgin olive oil, and then a quarter cup of nutritional yeast. And nutritional yeast is used in place of the Parmesan cheese. And then, of course, you're going to serve it with some croutons from fresh black pepper, and that is it. So that was our dinner last night. Really delicious comfort food and so satisfying. So I want to invite you all now to join me as I invite my guest on, Dr. Laura Ann Minkoff-Zern. As I said before, she is an associate professor of food studies and an affiliated faculty member in the Department of Geography and Women's and Gender Studies at Syracuse University. Dr. Minkoff-Zern's research and teaching broadly explores the interactions between food and racial justice, labor movements, and transnational environmental and agricultural policy. This focus builds on her extensive experience with agricultural biodiversity projects abroad, combined with work on immigrant health issues domestically. In her new book, The New American Farmer, Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability, she explores the experiences of Latino immigrant farmers as they transition from farm workers to farm owners, offering a new perspective on racial inequity and sustainable farming. And Dr. Minkoff-Zern argues that immigrant farmers, with their knowledge and experience of alternative farming practices, are, despite a range of challenges, actively and substantially contributing to the movement for an ecological and sustainable food system. She's also published in journals such as GeoForum, the Journal of Peasant Studies, Food, Culture, and Society, and Renewable Agriculture and Food Systems, among others. And she earned her PhD in geography from the University of California in Berkeley. And so, Laura, it's my pleasure to introduce you. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for the introduction.
Hi. Thank you for joining me. So let's talk first about your book, and who are the immigrant farmers that you talk about in your book? Just Latino farmers or a wider range?
So in my book, I really wanted to focus on people that were transitioning specifically from doing the labor of hired farm work on U.S. farms to starting their own farms. So that's majority in the United States, immigrant workers from Mexico and some from Central America. So in the book, I was really focused on first generation immigrants primarily from Mexico. That had been doing work on farms and then starting their own farm businesses. And so some identified as Latino, Latina, Hispanic, as well as some indigenous from southern Mexico and Central America as well.
Mm-hmm. And am I correct in assuming that these are all legal immigrants in order to start their own business? Do they need to be? Or is this also farmers that are undocumented in this country?
Yeah, so it surprisingly was a mix. I never explicitly asked anyone their documentation status, but it's something that, I could understand through the description of some of their challenges, and being undocumented certainly provided another challenge for them in that transition from being a worker to an owner. At first, I think a lot of people would assume that the barrier is just too high to be an undocumented worker in the United States and to start your own business. But the reality is people are able to make it work. It's not easy. But by working with other family members, a lot of them, even those that are documented, were renting or leasing land. They didn't own land. But they still had to provide certain forms of documentation just to sell at a farmer's market or to be organically certified. Oftentimes you have to provide a business number and ID to work with the USDA and get a loan. Certainly you can't be undocumented. So those that were undocumented had a whole other level of barriers, but yet some of them still were succeeding.
Because that's one of the things that I am constantly hearing about young farmers who want to start up here in this country, even Anglo-Saxon white farmers, that they have a hard time getting access to land. That, land is so expensive and getting access to it is so difficult. Are these immigrant farmers more willing to start in different locations than some of the farmers that I might be talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with immigrant farmers, at least those that I was speaking with, they are very much willing to start on very marginal land. So there were times when I would go visit a farm and I would actually have to drive through other people's property, right? And there was oftentimes no address for where they were farming. So while they had the same, I think, you know, kind of agrarian dream and vision as many of the, you know, white farmers born in the U.S. today of having a farm, living on their land, you know, having their own property that really was a place that they could form a homestead, for many of them, that's just not where they're starting. And because they are already, you know, linked into agrarian communities, you know, they would pick up land wherever they could get it, rent from their current owner, you know, farm on some land that maybe other people aren't willing to farm on. And many of them come from farming on marginal lands in Mexico themselves. And so it's something they're experienced with, you know, taking a plot of land that doesn't have great access to water, that doesn't have great access to the road, right? And just kind of dealing with those challenges. So yeah, they would take all different types of opportunities to start the farms that I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm. And in the book you discuss that they're using alternative and sustainable methods. But you specifically don't use the word organic. Can you discuss with us what is alternative and sustainable, if not organic? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and so the farmers that I was talking with, you know, included certified organic. Certainly, it's not to say that none of them were certified. But I looked at how organic certification is actually one of the barriers that some of them face. So there is a cost to being certified organic. And while some farmers would say, well, $500, that's nothing. For these farmers, that's something, right? And they have a very different type of customer base. You know, at a farmer's market, they might not be going for the same type of customers that, you know, are only buying certified organic. So it's not always a price premium that they get the advantage from, given that they can't market to wealthier consumers as well. And so what I say is it's not just organic. Some of them might be practicing very similarly to certified organic farmers, but might not be certified. You know, but I also included a broader definition of when I said alternative. So alternative meaning that they're generally smaller scale, so anywhere from 4 to about 40 acres. They were mostly using family labor, which of course is not always an ideal situation, but it is what it is in terms of staying small scale, that they are selling mostly to direct market consumers. So at a farmer's market, sometimes to a few restaurants, sometimes to community, but they, you know, essentially that they are alternative to what we think of in terms of big, you know, big agribusiness. And so, you know, one of the other big definers that I looked at was diversity. And so all of them were planting, you know, anywhere from 4 to 60 different crops in a season. So it's that I was trying to paint a picture of a broader type of alternative, not just something narrow, as narrow as certified organic.
Mm-hmm. And are they aware of the difference between organic and the difference in the markets for organic? And so, like, even if they're doing alternative practices, are they buying seeds that are non-GMO or non-radiated, those kind of things? Do they look at that?
Yeah, as much as possible, right? And I can't say any, you know, I don't want to generalize too much about it. It's a tough, as a social scientist, you're in a tough place where you're looking for generalizations, right? But at the same time, you want to recognize the diversity and differences of the people you talk to. And so I'd say, sure, some of them were certified organic. They were very conscious of where they were going to buy their seeds, obviously, if they're certified. You know, whereas others were more flexible about those things. You know, they buy seeds where they have access to seeds. They might be sharing seeds with neighbors. You know, none of them, certainly no one that I was talking to, was using explicitly GMO crops, because those types of crops don't do well in the type of diverse growing system that they were growing in, right? I mean, GMO crops are typically commodity crops, and none of them had high levels of machinery. They were all doing, you know, mostly fruit and vegetable production. And in a diverse system where you're not adding in a lot of, you know, agrochemicals, you're not going to succeed with a GMO crop. So that's not what they were doing. You know, and so while I said they weren't all certified, certainly the farms looked like what someone typically, an image that is painted of sustainable agriculture, is very much what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thanks. And as far as policy changes, you know, to support immigrant farmers, I know there's, you know, a lot of groups for farmers of color. Are immigrant farmers welcomed into those circles? And what kind of policy changes would you like to see happen to better support the immigrant farmers that are adding to our food system?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I looked at is how networked in are immigrant farmers into young farmer associations, sustainable farmer associations. And I think what I found from the farmer perspective, you know, among those that I talked to was they're not very networked into these groups. You know, sometimes it's explicit, kind of just, you know, people are accustomed to who they already network with. It's really difficult when there's a language barrier for them to join kind of, you know, organizations and groups. And a lot of it is they don't know any of those people, right? There's an explicit kind of social division between the young white farmers that are more college educated, that are coming in with these environmental kind of ideals around farming, which are wonderful. But they're not always aware of the people that are struggling to farm with even less resources, the people that don't speak English, the people that aren't at the same markets as them because they can't really kind of afford to get in, that don't know how to network with the restaurants. So I think there's just a lot of social division going on among farmers themselves. And that's not to say that those organizations aren't really working on that. I think, you know, different organizations like the Young Farmer a Coalition, the Greenhorn organization, they're really trying to face these things head on and look at, you know, racism in agriculture. And I know that there is a whole movement of people doing that, particularly among African-American farmers, you know, being more recognized
absolutely.
As part of this farming movement. But I think it is different for immigrants. You know, they're not just Latino farmers, they're immigrants, and they're not as socially networked as other, you know, people of color in the United States. Well, it depends on the region, of course. But in the very rural areas that I was in, you know, their social networks are the farm workers. They're not the farmers. And that's even among sustainable farmers. And so I think that that's changing. I really think a lot has been going on in the past several years among young and new farmer organizations to address that head on and to look at labor justice. And a lot of this has to start with looking at farm workers and farm worker rights at the same time, because these farmers are the same people that are also the workers. You know, and as far as policy, I think there's a lot that needs to be done. You know, California has been the most progressive in modeling the type of policy that I think could be seen. They passed a bill that I believe is called the Farmer Equity Act several years ago. And it was looking explicitly at, you know, recognizing racial discrimination in agricultural systems and looking at ways to enable more farmers of color, you know, to become active, and especially in sustainable farming circles. And so there was funding put there in the state of California and how to address these inequities and these barriers, which is really wonderful. And I don't think we've seen that done as systematically anywhere else. So I think, you know, especially given the current political moment we're in and the federal administration, you know, I think state level policy is the most, you know, hopeful. The state level is the most hopeful place we can see that policy shift happening. You know, that said, we can't forget the federal level and what's been going on. And what I talk about a lot in my book is, you know, structural discrimination, historical discrimination at places like the USDA, right? And our Department of Agriculture has a very, you know, sordid history of racism, which has been acknowledged through class action lawsuits, right? We know it's been happening, but yet not much has been done to change it. And mm-hmm. So, you know, during the Obama administration, when Vilsack was our Secretary of Agriculture, there was a lot of discussion about changing that, about making the Vilsack that this was going to be the civil rights era or something of that sort in agriculture. And intention was put there, but a lot of it was not followed through on. And then, of course, change administration, and we've gone backwards, literally backwards, in terms of making resources available in Spanish language, looking at how to help small-scale farmers, you know, specifically immigrant farmers and laborers. So it's, you know, I think it's, we have to keep pushing on those things. And I think policy is really important. It can't all be done at the individual level.
Right. You know, I am a NOFA New York board member. NOFA is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And I'm on the board, and one of the committees that I'm a member of is an equity committee, you know, where we're looking at inequality and race,
in farm workers and young farmers. And I know, you know, in the discussions I've been a part of, it is mostly talking about, you know, young farmers of color who are, you know, looking for access to land and are looking for equal rights as they deserve, of course. And yet I don't think there's been much discussion about the immigrant farmer. And so it's really wonderful to be having this conversation with you so I can bring this back to NOFA and to really, you know, try to explore some ways that we can bridge those gaps so that the networking is happening with the young farmers and farmers of color and that the immigrant farmers are brought into that fold. So how has...
Yeah, and I think COVID- a lot of it is just that kind of awareness that, you know, because they, you know, immigrant farmers tend to constantly be assumed to be farm workers. And you, even when I would call the USDA offices at the local regional levels and say, do you have anyone that works with Latino farmers, immigrant farmers? And immediately the response was always, oh, we don't work with farm workers. And that was really telling for me because even in areas where I was aware that there was a large immigrant farming community, you know, just various agencies and organizations just aren't aware that there are people that are starting their own businesses because they always appear to be workers, right? Even at the market, people just assume that they're, you know, not the owners, but they're the workers because that's how people are have become accustomed to seeing them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's been a lot of discussion with the COVID-19 and the pandemic, how farm workers, and now I'm not talking about immigrant farmers per se, I'm talking more about farm workers, they've been considered essential, and yet they're illegally, you know, illegally here, undocumented, but all of a sudden we're, you know, our government's happy to, you know, take, you know, look at a blind eye to allow them to continue while we need them. But the minute we don't need them, you know, the Trump administration will be there deporting them again with ICE. So can you talk a little bit about how farm workers have been dealing with this challenge during the pandemic, and has there been a new awareness and a way that my listeners can also support any petitions or any movement to make these people who are essential during a pandemic become essential at all times?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important point and, important question. You know, and so, of course, they've always been essential, right? And that's the most important thing. But now I think that, as you're pointing out, their vulnerability has really come to light as we constantly are hearing people, and not just farm workers, but all food workers, right? Grocery store workers, transportation workers, processing, you know, meat processing plant workers. And how do we keep supporting them, you know, in this moment and moving forward? You know, I mean, there was a great op-ed in the New York Times, you know, saying we need to recognize they were essential now and essential always, and we need to be giving amnesty to workers right now, which quite honestly, the opposite is happening. The Trump administration has actually put a proposal out there to lower farm worker wages, which seems, you know, unbelievable in this moment because, you know, well, I won't get into why, but we're certainly not seeing a federal government that is, you know, saying, let's support these workers. Certainly not. They're not being given amnesty. They're not being told that they're any more protected, even though they're essential. You know, as far as actions to be taken, I think it's following the different organizations that have been active in this time. You know, so I'm trying to think there's, you know, nationally, the Food Chain Workers Alliance is always a wonderful organization that's doing a lot to support workers up and down the food chain. So they, what I love about what they do is they connect the movement and struggle of farm workers to that of restaurant workers and grocery store workers, et cetera. So the Food Chain Workers Alliance is a really powerful one. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been doing so much in Florida to get, you know, protective gear out to workers and keep their movement going strong during all of this. Here in Central New York, where I am, there's two really amazing organizations, the Worker Center of Central New York, as well as the Cornell Farmworker Program. You know, I'm trying to think of like different organizations. I think the best thing too is
there's also ROC, the Restaurant Opportunities Coalition. Mm-hmm. I guess that's more for restaurant workers.
That's for restaurant workers. They and all of these organizations work with the Food Chain Workers Alliance.
Right.
So in Washington State. I'm trying to think of the name of the organization that's working out there. I'll think of it and I'll mention it. But I think, you know, finding in your area the organizations working with farm workers on the front lines and figuring out what you can do to support them is the most important thing. 'Cause there's so many, you know, great organizations out there. Families Unidas, por la Justicia.
Sorry, say that again.
In Washington State.
What are they called?
Familias Unidas por la Justicia is another organization working out of Washington State.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good. And I'll share those links on my website so that people who are listening, if they didn't get that down, can reach out to these organizations, because it's so important. You know, one of the things that I really like to advocate for is for all of us to really get involved when, you know, there's just so many issues that are important, and we can't all do everything, but we all can do something, and for everyone to participate in some way. And, you know, farm workers and immigrants have it so hard. I mean, right now I heard, you know, they're having a hard time getting testing, you know, for the pandemic. You know, here they are working in close quarters. Yes, mm-hmm. they might be outdoors if they're a farm worker, but still they don't have access to health care, health insurance. The government, they're not welcome to the government stimulus check. They don't get sick leave. You know, is anything being done to address these shortcomings for people who come from another country?
I mean, I wouldn't say anything comprehensive is currently being done. Like I said, there's just so many grassroots organizations on the ground that are working. You know, like I said, in Central New York, organizations are working on, you know, getting protective gear out to farm workers. And at least I know the Cornell Farm Worker Program, I work on a project with Mary Jo Dudley, who's the director there. And she was saying that, you know, she calls up the state, our county health department, her county health department down there, and you ask for protective gear for farm workers, and they say, oh, well, we don't have that many to spare, right? And unfortunately, even when gear is available for other essential workers, farm workers aren't seen as the top of the list. You know, we can assume what reasons we want to assume. But, you know, they're essential, but again, not being given the protections. Like you said, they don't get the stimulus check if they're undocumented. They don't have, in most states, the same rights as other workers legally, to things like a weekend, to things like sick leave. So it's rare that they have those benefits to be able to take the days off that they need if they get sick. And of course, what's important to understand about agriculture is that people are working in very close quarters. You know, they're working in very tight conditions in the fields, in trucks getting to and from work. Because they're low income, they tend to live in very cramped housing. You know, so we've already seen massive outbreaks of COVID in farm worker communities. We've seen it up here in upstate New York in Madison County. We've seen it in New Jersey. We've seen it in Florida. So it's already happened, obviously, in the meatpacking plants as well.
Yeah, it's really discouraging. What are some of the other issues that you cover in your book? You know, in some of the challenges that immigrant farmers have to actually get started. What are some of their biggest challenges?
Well, I think the biggest challenge, right, which is something that all new farmers struggle with, is access to capital, right? Just the money that you need to start a business. And that's why many of them go into fruit and vegetable farming, because I'd say you need the lowest amount of capital. You can do it on somewhat marginal land. You don't need a ton of equipment. You know, the biggest cost for fruit and vegetable production is labor, right? And that's what they have. They have their ability to work hard and work many hours. They have the family that can work with them. You know, so just not having access to money, not having access to, you know, the ability to take out loans in the same way that many other people do in the U.S., because many of them don't have the type of credit they need. They don't have, you know, so then in addition to capital, they don't have formal education. So many of them, when they come here, have not been to, you know, formal schooling past elementary or middle school, and that would have been in Spanish. And so for many of them, just not having the same literacy skills, and certainly not the same, you know, English language skills. And the reality is there's actually a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork to being a farmer. And, you know, when we talk about why they don't become certified organic, that's a whole other layer of paperwork, which, again, no farmer, you know, likes paperwork. Certainly no one gets into farming to do paperwork. But if people haven't even gone through high school, and certainly haven't gone through high school in English, that paperwork is an enormous barrier to fill things out properly. So ironically, when the USDA was sued for discriminating against Hispanic and Latino farmers. And at the end of the day, when farmers were able to file claims to get, you know, get the benefit of that lawsuit after the USDA, you know, essentially lost the battle, the reason that, you know, over 80% of the people that filed claims that they weren't able to get the benefit was because they didn't fill out the paperwork properly, right? So even when they're trying to claim a benefit that's specifically for them, this is a really huge barrier. You know, so everything from not having access to money, right, which is of course is related to access to land and other resources like seeds and water and transportation, to just the educational and linguistic barriers, you know, to then just social networks. So not having the same sustainable agriculture connections, you know, going into the top restaurants in New York City, and being able to network in the same way that other farmers can, that's a huge barrier to them. So, mm-hmm. you know, there are a lot of barriers. And I do talk a lot about that in the book. At the same time, you know, the message of the book is getting to the fact that they're doing it anyways, which is really incredible. And so it's not easy, but it's very surprising, I think. And when I first started the research and I said, I'm going to research and talk to immigrant farmers and people involved, heavily involved in agriculture, said, you know, that there's no way that this was possible, right? There's no way this is happening. You know, I think that's what was incredible about doing the research is that it is happening. It's happening all over the country, really against great odds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'd love to see some more organization happening, you know, amongst these farmers so that they're starting more of their own groups as well so that they have a larger voice. Because I think that's, you know, even in the school system, you know, when immigrant families come into the school system, you know, they don't get the same services that they're, you know, that the other counterparts get because they don't have the parent advocate that's advocating for special needs or special services. And, you know, they don't have that voice that you need. You know, they always say the squeaky wheel gets the grease, you know?
Yeah.
And they need to, you know, they need a voice and mm-hmm. some organization to really help them.
Yeah, and there is a Latino and rancher farming organization. They're more lobby-based out of Washington, D.C., and there are some really good advocates there working at the policy level. But, you know, uh-huh. that's one organization with a few staff members, and so it's not happening in that kind of movement type of way that it is for many, you know, many other farmers.
You know, well, so, yeah, there is a lack of representation. Really moving. That's anything pro-people. It's pro corporate, industrial, real estate, whatever. So farm workers across the board, farmers, no matter where they come from, are struggling because they're mm-hmm. just not getting the benefits that they need. As far as what the immigrant farmers are growing, one thing I love when I've gone to, you know, a farmer's market that has some Latino farmers is all the vegetables that I don't even know what they are. So mm-hmm. They must have a whole separate market for some of the vegetables that they grow. Can you talk a little bit about what they're growing?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the first thing when I visit a farm is that, you know, they would tour me around their farm and just go over the dozens and dozens of different types of products they were growing. And so like you were pointing to, many of them are growing, you know, crops that are common to their own diet. You know, everything from, you know, kind of corns, you know, beans, squash, you know, to varieties of herbs that, you know, people born in the U.S. might not be familiar with. And so they would adjust what they were growing to different levels, to the different types of consumer bases that they were going for. Certainly some of them had a lot of Latina customers and were able to sell a lot of varieties of beans or herbs, or even some of them, you know, particular varieties of corn that they might not be able to sell to, say, the typical white consumer. But, you know, all of them at some point had, you know, were also growing things and marketing to the white consumer base in order to keep their business going. And certainly some of them had particular, you know, Mexican grocery stores that they would sell to as well. But for all of them, it was some kind of mix. You know, some of them, especially in some of the more competitive markets like California and the Bay Area, would even have to narrow some of that to fit the market because there's just so many small scale, you know, alternative farmers there. So they'd say, well, I started growing all these different things, but I couldn't get into the high-end market. So now I'm really just growing heirloom tomatoes and some other things for my family. But that wasn't as common. Most of them are growing and selling in areas where they were able to get into markets. I looked at 5 different regions across the country. And so what was really striking is just the diversity of crops. You know, just everything you can imagine. I went to one farm that was saying, oh, well, you know, we started connecting with these, you know, Japanese customers, and they couldn't find they really wanted certain varieties of eggplants. So we started growing all these different varieties of Japanese eggplants that we didn't know about. You know, so that was really cool to see kind of different immigrant communities connecting over varieties that they couldn't find in the grocery store. And certainly they, you know, even if what they primarily sold in the market was not something that was in their own diet, you know, they were still always growing for their family alongside that, you know, so some of them might say, well, I grow these crops primarily for market, but if you look over here, this is what I grow for my own community. So there was always a lot of that. And so no matter what, even if they had narrowed their diversity, they still were growing a lot of different crops when you went to visit the farm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, another thing that I have heard a lot that actually infuriates me is, you know, people who feel like they're against immigration because immigrants are taking jobs from Americans. You know, do you believe that's true? I mean, in what you've seen, the kind of work that these farmers are doing, do you feel like people are, you know, Americans would be lining up to take those jobs?
Right. So there's the question of farm workers and then farmers. So I guess I could start with farm workers because that's, you know, the majority of jobs in agriculture are farm laborer jobs. And certainly what we've seen really since the 1940s, is that white people are not working in agriculture, right? There's, even before that, there's been a long history of agriculture being the work of people of color, right? I mean, obviously agriculture since
slavery.
Colonization, right? We had slavery. And so this has been devalued labor for as long as, you know, as long as there have been white-owned farms. And that's really important to remember because this is such hard, skilled work, right? I tried farming for a year. I realized that my kind of, you know, agrarian fantasy of farming was just so wrong. It's just, it's such difficult work, and it's, you know, this is kind of what brought me to this research, is that they're not just workers, right? They're it's considered technically unskilled labor, which I think couldn't be more wrong. The idea right. that someone could just go in and fill in this job if somehow we, you know, took all the immigrants out of agriculture. I mean, our food system would absolutely fall apart because this is work that takes a very long time to learn how to do properly and efficiently. And so it's not just a matter of it being underpaid and undervalued, which it is, right? I mean, most white people wouldn't do this work until you paid them a much higher wage.
And the long hours and no days off if it's in season. Yeah. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah, it's really difficult. But beyond that, it's just not work that you can walk into with no experience. So no, I mean, the simple answer is no, they're definitely not taking the jobs of U.S.-born people. And because we're not willing to do the work, and what's really interesting in this current moment is there's actually been some proposals to say, well, we're going to have high unemployment, let's get U.S. worker, U.S.-born workers into farm worker positions. And it's just it's hilarious. You know, I mean, because anyone that's been involved in agriculture knows there's no way that's going to happen. Even the most unemployed, you know, out of work, struggling U.S. born person, you know, they could try it for a few days, but we've seen time and time again that they won't stick with it. Certainly the past several generations of U.S. workers just have no connection to agricultural labor. They don't know how to perform this work, and they certainly won't do it for the wage that's being offered currently. So the United Farm Workers did, I mean, it was more of a gimmick than anything. They did a Take Our Jobs campaign. And there was a great clip of Stephen Colbert going out and highlighting this campaign. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, even when people come and try and take farm worker jobs, they just don't stay. And you can talk to many farmers that have said, sure, I would love to not have to worry about the problem of undocumented workers and worry about raids, right? The problem being from top down. But they know that they can't get workers to do that work and to do it well. And so certainly it's not a situation where they're taking anyone's jobs. In fact, what we're seeing is since there's been more of a fear of raids, since the border's been militarized over the past decade, what we've had is an increase in what's called the H-2A guest worker program. So more and more what we're seeing is that farm workers are actually not undocumented, that they're coming in with a guest worker visa to work for 10 months or less in agriculture. And that's actually something that Trump has been very supportive of, because it's a way to legally have you know, immigrant workers in U.S. agriculture, but it also points to this, you know, ridiculous argument that there'd be some kind of U.S.-born worker that would take the job, right? Because even when, you know, there's high unemployment, we're still going to see the H-2A program expand in this moment, because right. that's the dependence that we have on immigrant labor in the food system, you know, as it currently stands.
And then for actual farm owners?
For farm owners, right. I mean, so then, you know, what's really interesting about this moment of immigrant farm workers starting their own farms is that what we see right now is that, you know, white farmers are retiring. The average farmer is over 65 years old in the United States, and that their kids don't want to take on the farm, right? And then the average, you know, new farmer, beginning farmer that's not coming from a farming family is not making it. Right? Because they don't realize how hard it is. They know that they have options, right? A lot of people try farming for a few years and realize this is not, it's not really a viable economic, you know, venture in this country right now. It is so difficult.
Most of the farmers I know have to have it. I was going to say most of the farmers I know have to have a job on the side, or at least one
Absolutely.
Of them. You know, might be a couple, and then, you know, at least, you know, they have a job on the side so they can get some health insurance for the family or something, you know, because otherwise, it's just too astronomical if they had to come up with health insurance as well.
Exactly. And so it's not, this is not a situation that most people that have other options want to be taking on, right? And the difference with immigrant farm workers that start their own farms is this is what they know, right? And it's not just that it's, you know, on one hand, it's they're limited in their career options once they get, you know, some savings. And if they're going to start their own business, they're going to start with the skills that they have. And they come from farming families. They come from farming backgrounds. They know how to farm. They're really skilled farmers. And so this is a business that makes sense for them. It's not a business that makes sense for most people born in the United States, where, you know, less than 2% of our population is involved in agriculture in any way. So no, they're not taking anyone's jobs.
Right. And we really, really need farmers desperately. Like you said, yeah. You know, our farmers are older, and you know, this is a job that we really need farmers, you know, people to take up. So anyway, thank you so much for your research. We're just about out of time. Laura Ann, you want to just let people know how they can reach out to you if they have any further questions? And of course, your book, The New American Farmer: Immigration, Race, and the Struggle for Sustainability, is available, you know, with Amazon and most bookstores, correct? Although bookstores are closed again.
Yeah, you can even go directly to the MIT Press website and get it there for the same price. So, okay. You know, you can go to MIT Press and find The New American Farmer. You can go to Amazon and find The New American Farmer. You can, if you want, I'm in the process of actually building a website now, a little bit delayed, but you can find my other work if you look me up at Syracuse University.
Wonderful. Thank you, Laura Ann, so much for your knowledge and putting the word out there that this is a group of immigrants that need our support and that we need. So it's a mutually beneficial synchronistic relationship. So thank you so much for your work. Everyone who's been listening, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.
Yeah.